It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we are here on this chilly but absolutely magnificent December Saturday morning. It's just beautiful out there, isn't it?
Not even really chilly.
No, actually, I was surprised because I got in the car in the garage, and the garage had cooled off overnight, so it was a little chilly, and then I was real surprised when I stepped out of the car at the station here. The sun was getting some heat in it. Man, we're just on a tear lately weather-wise.
No doubt.
Loving every minute of it. Anyway, I should say welcome to everybody. Regulars out there, thanks for being there again and again. And we keep hearing from more and more of you, and we are always encouraged. That keeps us going on and coming back week after week and looking forward to it. And if you're new to the show and somebody told you about it or just forgot to turn your radio or something like that, then stick around for the hour. We'll promise you little in life, but we'll promise you that you will always learn something. No matter how useful or otherwise, you will learn something in the course of the hour, because we always do. And so if you want to do what you do and talk about what you want to talk to, you can give us a call at 904-222-8255, and we will put you to the head of the class. So we got a lot to do today. We got a little wrap up from last week we want to talk about, and just all kinds of things going on out there. It was jobs week. We got to talk about that. It's another week where the market performed well. A lot of green numbers. They weren't hugely green, but green is my favorite color. And where we're going from here, this is an era of mixed signals, and you'll be hearing more of that today, I'm sure. So without getting any more detailed myself, I'll just turn it over and say, what happened this week?
So you kind of summed it up well, that we saw 2023 highs on both the NASDAQ and the S&P this week, but then they both immediately pulled back after reaching those highs. So are we pushing ahead, or are we going to consolidate? I don't know. The market's gotten a bit overbought lately, and a really good November. In fact, one of the better months that I can remember in recent history.
Really?
Has went from extreme oversold levels in the market to overbought. So when that happens, it's not unusual to see a consolidation phase. It's really what happens next that's important. If the market does start to drop, there isn't a lot of support in the very close levels, so it would probably drop a little ways. But if we see it push ahead, look out, because that would be new 2023 highs, and it would really be a solid confirmation of the uptrend we've been seeing. So I don't know what's going to happen next, but it'll be really interesting to watch. The market's been on a bit of a tear lately, so it wouldn't surprise me if that continued. And it's a seasonal, from a seasonal perspective, that is usually what happens this time of year, particularly in the second half of December. I'm mildly encouraged, but I'm, again, not making any predictions.
Yeah, one thing we've been talking about both on the show and in the office is that this has been such a strange year, because if you look at the pure numbers, it's been a good year in the market. People are making money.
I think we had another four clients come in this week, and all of them said, oh, gosh, what's it going to be? How bad is it?
And we look them in the eye and laugh and say, you might not believe this, but you're going to want to see it, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So we're sitting there, I'm looking at the year-to-date numbers. My gosh, we close the door today. There's not a soul in the world that would argue with us. We'd take this and call it a year.
I thought a good year would be 4 or 5% up, really, going into this year. And it's exceeded my expectations by four times, I think. So
no, but I got some stuff for later in the show on what people are saying about next year. That's going to be very interesting too.
Yeah, but they don't know. if they're saying it looks bad, it'll probably be good. So we'll see.
Well, if you note, there are two pieces of paper here, and there's a reason for that.
Sure, you can find both.
Exactly.
The Dow was essentially flat this week. It rose just a couple of points, and I don't mean percentage points. It literally rose like 2 points on the Dow, so really a flat week. The S&P added 0.2%. The NASDAQ had a pretty decent week. It added 0.7%. Small caps performed a bit better, gaining 1.3%, while mid caps gained just under 0.4%. So A little bit of a spread there between 0 and 1.3%, really depended how you were invested this week, whether you had a okay week or a good week. Things overseas were not a whole lot better than they were here. In fact, China really took it on the chin this week. They dropped 4.4%. Hong Kong was off 2.4%. China's now off 20% this year, and Hong Kong is off 14%. European markets fared a little better. They gained between 0.5% and 1.5% in the case of France. Actually, I think the UK was off a little bit. I forgot to check that one specifically this morning. Some of the recent high flyers went in different directions. India was up 1.6%, but Mexico was up just 0.2%. And then Brazil, one of the darlings recently, was down 1.7%. So kind of a big spread on there too. Commodities had a terrible week, just really awful. The price of oil dropped almost 4%. The price of natural gas was down almost 8%. Gold was down 3.3%, and silver was down 9.5%. You can imagine the commodities basket index was down. It was down fairly substantially at 3.4%. So rough week for commodities investors. Fixed income markets were a bit mixed. The 10-year Treasury yield ended up slightly during the week, although it had been down and then it had been up higher, and it ended up just a hair up. And the results were kind of reflected that movement. The ETF AGG, the aggregate bond market, was up less than 0.1%, while short treasuries were down 0.2%, but long treasuries actually rallied, gaining 1.7%. So a little bit all over the place on fixed income. With the recent plunge in the price of oil, gas prices have also come way down. In September, prices were up around $4 a gallon nationwide, and the average now is just $3.18 per gallon. The price of gas has now fallen 3 cents per gallon in 2023, so we're down from the beginning of the year. I feel like it's a long time since we've said that.
No, a long time.
And the other thing is that is falling is mortgage rates. They were above 8% and now are down around 7.4%. So that was a little bit of good news for the consumer going into the holiday season. The big news this week was the jobs numbers, and things were decent, I would say. We're running out of time. I do want to get into this, but it's kind of a longer topic, and so I think we should probably leave it for after the break.
Okay, and when we do come back, we, as usual, have the trivia question, a whole bunch more on the jobs and why it has, if anything, added a little more to our pre-existing just question mark as to where this whole thing is going to wind up. Maybe the Fed will stop. Maybe the Fed won't stop. Maybe the Fed will cut. Maybe it won't. These are all questions in the wind. And then we want to talk just a little bit, as I promised last week, about Charlie Munger and his passing at the ripe old age of 99. And a lot of you know who Charlie is, and some of you may have even seen him in person because a lot of people go to the Berkshire Hathaway meetings. And Craig Beechler, who was in the office with us or in the studio with us last week, has spoken with him on more than one occasion.
He goes to that Berkshire meeting every year.
Yeah, he's going to miss him, we'll put it that way. So, all right, well, we'll take a little break and be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we have a trivia question of the day, as usual, brought to you by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 904-636-7888. I had mentioned right before the break about Charlie Munger, who was Warren Buffett's right hand for many, many, many years in Berkshire Hathaway. And he has... He has had, unfortunately, no longer, but he has had a lot to say over time. I'll touch on a few of those a little later when we're done with the market wrap. But the trivia question is about Charlie Munger and Berkshire Hathaway. During the time that Munger was with Berkshire Hathaway, what was the percentage return for investors? Excuse me. You can think big.
Yeah. It's going to give you a hint that it's substantial.
Yeah.
It's a higher than the S&P return.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, you want to wrap up, start with the jobs?
Yep, no problem. The big news this week was those job numbers, and it was pretty good overall. I mean, not it wasn't terrible. It wasn't blockbuster. It wasn't bad. It was somewhere in the middle. The more surprising thing to me was the reaction of the stock market, because it wasn't bad news, and that's what the stock market has been reacting positively to over the last year. The worse things got, the more they liked it, because the more they thought the Fed would stop raising rates. But this report was actually decent, and the stock market reacted decently. So that, to me, that's a more normal set of circumstances. So I think that's a good thing.
Goldilocks numbers. Not too hot, not too cold.
Right. That. Yeah. You definitely didn't want to see a really hot number on this report. And it didn't. The ADP report came out first. It showed a moderate increase of 103,000 jobs. And it showed slowdowns in hiring in both manufacturing and services. But the largest gain was in trade, transportation, and utilities. That makes sense. Right before the holidays, transportation would be ramping up to deliver all the holiday shopping goods, especially the online type orders. Overall, it was a good report, but it showed slower growth, but still growth. The non-farm payrolls report came out on Friday, and it was close to the estimate was 185,000. It came in at 199,000. However, the previous two reports were revised down by 35,000, so this actually made the net jobs come in under the forecast. The report caused the unemployment rate to drop to 3.7% from 3.9%, so it actually went down.
Yeah, weird, huh?
Yeah. Hourly earnings were up 0.4% in November. That's a pretty good jump, and that's up 4% from a year ago. So that number is actually higher than the current inflation rate. So that's something we haven't seen in quite a while. But yeah, so that's something I think the Fed will be looking at very closely in the coming months about what to do with rates. When you're seeing wages go up faster than inflation, I think that will be a positive, and that would be an argument against further rate hikes. Aggregate hours worked was up 0.3% for the month and 1.3% from the year ago. Not terrible numbers. Civilian employment, which includes small business startups, was up 747,000 in November, and that is actually what pushed the unemployment rate down. All these people starting new businesses, and that can be as simple as taking a 1099 job, driving Uber, working for one of the Instacart, that kind of thing, where you're not a full-time employee, you just work when you want to. So people are either starting new businesses like crazy right now, or they're taking on second jobs to cover holiday expenses. I'm not exactly sure, but I think the holiday expenses thing would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, 25% of Americans haven't even paid off last Christmas yet.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's not good.
No.
Yeah. So what that was do? It. What are your thoughts
on that? I'm thinking that's probably... What you're looking at is a bunch of people are realizing that it's a lot more expensive out there today than it was a couple of years ago. And overall wages are still down on a real basis over the last 3 years, about 3%. And I think a lot of people are thinking, man, if I'm going to have any luck buying more expensive Christmas presents this year, I got to get some cash in my pocket. I think you're right about doing things like Uber and delivery jobs and part-time in stores or whatever.
Yeah.
Plus, you look at the minimum wage now.
Oh, I know. It's not like you're going out and getting $7 an hour.
No, grab a part-time job.
Forget the minimum wage. No one's hiring for the minimum wage. And they really never have, except for high school kids.
Right.
Like, these people, like, if you go part-time at Target right now, you're probably making north of $15 an hour.
Yeah, 18-20 is pretty common in part-time jobs right now. So if you're looking for 5-10 hours a week somewhere and some local business needs your help, you can put away a pretty good chunk of change in that time at those values.
No doubt about it.
You know, it's always difficult because you know those things are inflationary, and the inflation causes you to need more money, which makes you have to work harder. But by working harder, you contribute to the inflation. It's a big vicious circle. But if you're just thinking about it as a person trying to pay his bills, I think there's a lot of them out there that are working part-time.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And that's fine. There are still more jobs than people looking right now, even though the jolt.
It's come down from two open jobs for every people looking down to 1.4 open jobs, but that's still above the historical norm of somewhere around 1.2.
And there are still a lot of people on the sidelines out there who who are not yet going back to work, and a lot of it is still living off the fat of the land from the COVID payouts, handouts years, although that's becoming less and less, and I don't know where or when yeah, we're going next.
I don't really think that's a thing anymore. I think the only people that have savings left from that are people that were already didn't need, who are already saving.
Yeah, you may be right. The marginal workforce is probably
long gearing up. Ago burned through that.
Yeah, it doesn't take long these days.
No.
As you know. And anyway, my forecast for next year is, I don't know. Here's a couple of them. These are the ones I was telling you about a little bit ago. All right, here's one from Yahoo Finance, and it says S&P 500 to see small gain in 2024 as U.S. economic risks rise. That was a Reuters poll. All right, they're talking 3-4%, something like that.
Well, that's what I thought about this year, so there's that.
And now from the same week, if not the same day, I don't remember if they were in the exact same day. This is from November 28th, so it's very recent. This one is from Investment News. S&P 500 to reach record high of 5,000 in 2024, and calculated from where it was on that day, that's up 10%. So I have these marked to keep in my folder for further review for another year. Let's see if either of these was close. Nobody would have gotten this year right, I don't think.
No, I didn't hear anyone predicting a rebound like we saw this year.
No, neither of us was anywhere near on board that bandwagon. So we'll see. One of the things I'm looking at from a longer-term perspective, we have been moving into quite a bit of money market, fixed income stuff, U.S. treasuries and so on, because the rates have been creeping up over 5, and they're starting to soften a little bit. And I'm wondering now, should people be locking in some longer terms, things like that? We did discuss that a little bit in the office this week. But I think we're probably not going to go a lot higher on money market funds and so on. That's the bad news. The good news is you can still make money on your money without taking a great deal of risk.
Well,
even if it's a little less in 24 than in 23.
The good news is in a falling rate environment, you don't need to. You don't need to do that. You don't have to lock in.
Sure.
All you need to do is buy a bond fund. Mm-hmm. And if those rates start coming down, that bond fund could potentially see equity-like returns.
Yep.
So that's what my plan would be, or is, I guess, is to move back into the same corporate bond funds that we sold out of in early 22. I would move back into those now. I think you can't time the market, but if you expect rates to start falling, that's a good place to jump into.
Yeah, I've been looking into and chipping away at the longer term bonds on the zeros, the things that really leverage up. It's not going to do much until rates actually start falling.
Yeah, but once they start falling, it's too late.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
You got to
stick your neck out a little bit to be a winner in this thing.
Right. The good news is the money market fund actually ticked up by 0.01%. The one that we used, it went from 5.25 to 5.26. So
I'm not surprised because that was late in the week, I assume, because there was a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction to the...
I'm not sure when it happened, but it did tick up just a bit.
Those are pretty nice numbers for a gigantic money market fund that... It basically doesn't entail risk for
the
investor.
Is designed to not lose value and just give you an interest payment.
Yep. All right, Charlie Munger, a guy that I often agree with and sometimes don't, one of my favorites. He said Alan Greenspan was smart, but he was totally overdosed on Ayn Rand when he was young. What the heck does that mean? When I think of Alan Greenspan, Rand never enters my mind.
No.
That's the truth. And then there's one I couldn't think of a better way to put it than what Charlie said. He said, Bitcoin was noxious poison. Charlie didn't have a minute in his life for Bitcoin. I think he's being a little bit on the practical side. Now, the one that I think is controversial, perfectly understandable, but controversial, is he says, and this is a quote, the whole secret of investment is to find places where it is safe and wise not to diversify. Now, that sounds a little interesting, doesn't it? But you got to remember the type of business these guys have. When they go in and decide that they found a good company at a decent price, they don't buy a few shares. They'll pretty much buy the company.
Mm-hmm.
So they were putting gigantic placements into the investments they were making, and we can't do that. We'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we've been sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, commiserating, I guess, about the state of the world and how these conflicts within parties are raising hell. I tell you one thing for sure. It's a presidential election year coming up, and it's going to be a doozy.
Oh, boy.
I can make one prediction that I'm absolutely guaranteed to be right. It's going to be wild.
Yep.
If you like this kind of thing, stay tuned.
It drives me crazy, but yep. Of course it affects everything that we do, so we have to pay attention.
Absolutely.
But it's not my favorite topic by any stretch.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we'll see what happens. It's going to be interesting.
I got one more I want to discuss about Munger a little bit. He says their concept was to buy wonderful businesses at fair prices. They were not necessarily shopping for great value. They wanted to pay a fair price for a business that was superior in their minds for long term. And when they say buy and hold, they could mean decades of holding.
Oh, they've held multiple businesses for decades.
Which is why the trivia question, what was the percent return for Berkshire Hathaway investors during Munger's many, many decades with the company? And it is a very large number. But then I caught this little tidbit. At Munger's death, he owned three stocks personally. Just three. One, of course, Berkshire Hathaway.
Which I would argue is like holding a mutual fund.
Yeah, I would argue the same.
Or an ETF.
And let's face it, that alone, his investment in it made him a billionaire times whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But another interesting one to me, one I don't know anything about, is Daily Journal Corp, DJCO. I didn't
never,
look it up. I don't
never
know.
Heard of it.
We know what it sounds like. But the other one in the big three that he would hold personally is Costco. So if I wanted to invest in a stock that I thought had a great potential, I'd look at where my money goes, and every month when I pay my bills, I think they're the number one recipient of what goes out. So I have to say, I agree with Charlie on that one completely. And speaking of rich people, Jeff Bezos, remember probably from a couple of weeks ago, we said welcome to Florida, because he decided he was going to become a Florida resident, and we did the background on it from the taxes. And the state of Washington, much to no one's surprise, had made what I call a really stupid concept, where they were adding a tax to long-term capital gains over and above the federal tax. It was like 7% more. And when you look at the amount of capital gains built into Bezos' wealth, that's a lot of money to save.
That would put you around 30% for capital gains,
yeah,
right? Something like that?
Yeah, which is...
if you're in a high tax bracket.
Exactly. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But and here's one. A lot of you have been listening to us for a long, long time. In some cases, a couple of decades. One of the things that I've long said, and Adam has also, is one of the reasons we shy away from stock picking, individual stock picking, is because good things happen to bad companies. Good things happen to their stock. Bad things happen to the stock of good companies. And we could name countless examples. But Bezos said the other day something that kind of sums that up that I thought was well put. He said, the stock is not the company, and the company is not the stock. And if you remember back, well, a couple of decades ago, when he was building Amazon, everybody said, he'll never make a penny. Oh, wait, that was me that said that.
That was you. I remember that.
Yeah, he'll never, ever make a profit. And his stock was flying high because he was growing like crazy, and the internet craze was there, and everybody was counting the hits you get on websites and that kind of thing. And then all of a sudden it started getting bigger and bigger, and he wasn't making any money. and the stock was getting punished. But he knew that that company had the potential. He just stuck with it and kept going. And I don't think anybody needs to question how it worked out for him. I think he did okay. Love him or hate him, you got to admire what he did. So I thought that was interesting. Another rich person. I'm on rich people topics right now, but not for long. Tesla. Tesla in Sweden. You're going to love this one if you're the right kind of person. The Swedish government decided, let's see how they put it. They refused to deliver license plates to Teslas.
Wait,
now, why?
Wait, say that again.
They refused to deliver license plates to Tesla owners.
Okay, why?
Because their mechanics, automobile mechanics, were on strike, and they were doing this in sympathy with the auto workers that were on strike.
Because they just don't have as many mechanical issues as regular cars?
I think it's kind of a non sequitur. But now the Swedish Supreme Court has ruled that the Tesla owners can come to the agency and pick up their license plates. They're just not going to mail them out.
What? It's the weirdest thing I've ever heard.
Leave it to me to uncover some of the goofiest stuff ever, right? All right, let's go on to something. Another thing that's near and dear to my heart. Those of you who are and have been loyal listeners for a long time know about the Secure 1.0 and the Secure 2.0 Act. And these were kind of massive changes in such things as retirement funding and the qualified plans and all that. But when Secure 2.0 passed, it had some technical problems. It happens a lot when you pass big legislation. There's some little tweaks that have to be made so they go back and do it. But this one was particularly poorly put together from what I can gather. So they now have put together, out of two committees in Congress, they've put together exactly the same wording for the technical changes that need making. And one of the things that, one of the disappointments I had was when they raised the RMD age, and they took it to from 70 and a half to 72 and then to 73, but they excluded the year 1950 from it. Just happened to be the year of my birth, so I didn't get that one. But now there's a technical glitch in the way 2.0 was done, and it's intended to go now up to age 75. But the way it was written, it came out more like that wasn't going to happen. So it's a very simple fix, not a big deal, but it's part of a number of things that were wrong with this thing, including things like charging or making wealthier people, if they're going to do any catch-up contributions because they're 50 or older, if they're making more than $145,000, they had to make it on a after-tax basis, meaning a Roth-style catch-up contribution. I don't particularly like it. I'm not going to jump up and down and yell and scream and call it a terrible idea or anything like that. But the way the thing was written, now, technically, if you read it like an attorney would, you read the words and see what they mean, there will be no catch-up contributions allowed after 2024. Obviously, a tweak that has to get made. And here's where regular old people can get frustrated. They've got this package put together. The Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee came up with the fixes. They're identical. So they're taking them to the floor. Now, what would Nike say? Just do it. You've got agreement from everybody. Just do it. But no, the dysfunctional Congress can't get its act together and take a vote on this thing. So instead, they're looking for a must-pass package of laws that they can tack this onto. Jeez. It might or might not get done in December. So we might or might not go into the new year knowing the rules for next year or the year after.
Which is not unusual.
No, it isn't. But all they have to do is schedule a vote and vote. This is one of those things that passed the House by something like 413 votes.
Yeah.
Out of 435.
That's right. I remember that.
The fix would pass even more than that,
most likely. And there's nothing controversial in there. It is simply clarifying what was already the intent of the original bill, which was already agreed upon. It was just poorly worded.
Match the words to the intent and put it into practice. But no, they might not be able to find anything that they have to pass.
You know, I don't hate the catch-up Roth contribution. I'll tell you why. Because if you are making if you're making enough that you are forced to do that, you are almost assuredly not allowed to do a Roth IRA. So therefore, this is your chance to do a Roth IRA. And yes, you get taxed on it, and yes, you're going to pay a lot to get that in there. But the ability to take that Roth into retirement that you're probably never going to spend and then pass that on to your kids is actually really benefiting your kids in that way.
I'm going to give you every bit of that argument.
It's not terrible.
Another of the tweaks in the Secure 2.0 correction bill is involving the SEP IRAs and simple IRAs, where they want to now make it such that Roths will be available in there. I don't think they're going to mandate that just yet, but they want to make sure that most everybody can do that if they want to. It's a very simple thing, again, and very beneficial to the people who are, in some cases, the lesser paid people, because when you make a deductible contribution and you're not making much money, you're not saving much in taxes, so you're better off with a Roth. And as you just said, if you're maxing out your other one anyway and you're making more money, it would not hurt to do a Roth. So all these things are just common sense things. All they have to do is get passed, and Congress can't get its act together to put a simple package like that out on the floor because they don't work.
Yeah.
It is the 9th day of December right now. They have almost no time left, millions of things to do, and they're somewhere else. I know, complain, right? That's it. All right, we're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. This is the Vanwee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Vanwee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Vanwee.
And I'm Adam Vanwee.
And we were just chuckling in the break. First, I should say, lines are open, 904-222-8255. And the trivia question is there. During Charlie Munger's tenure with Berkshire Hathaway, what was the percentage return to their investors? And it's big. Adam asked me a couple questions in the break, and I'm going to admit to everybody, I wasn't even close. We should make a definition here. A median is not an average.
Right.
A median means that there are as many readings below that number as above. And it doesn't mean a lot for a lot of types of statistics, but it works really well on a body of large numbers. When you got a really, really big sample size, why don't you go ahead and read the question?
First, I want to preface it with the gender pay gap is talked about all the time by politicians, and they bring up the stat of 78 cents on the dollar. And if you read any real research, that has been completely debunked by more than one female researcher. In fact, I think it was the head economics chair at Harvard that did a study on it and found it was like 1-2% maybe. And so that it's just not true, but this is real. There is a gender gap, but it is not on pay. It's actually on savings. And so when asked about savings, women feel like they don't have enough saved for retirement at a rate of about 6% more than men. Well, there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
They don't have as much saved for retirement as men do. Men. The median man has saved $9,000 for retirement.
And I don't mind telling people that I guessed $110,000.
Right. But you have to remember, there's a lot of people who are starting their careers, especially with the way the demographics are, where the millennial generation is so large, and the even the Gen Z after them is larger than Gen X in the middle, which has almost none. And then, so they're at $9,000. The median woman has saved only $2,400 for retirement. So there is a huge gap between men and women when it comes to retirement savings. Now, there's all sorts of reasons for that. But That is truly, truly a gap that needs to be closed. And I think it will be over time because of historically there was a gender pay gap. Now that's closing. And I think that will directly lead to the median savings number for women increasing as well. So we'll see how that progresses over time. But I was kind of shocked by those numbers.
Obviously, I was too, since I was so off.
The other interesting thing in this same article that I was reading was that 32% of investors said they believe the U.S. economy will fall into recession within 12 months if their preferred political party is not victorious. Think about that, because that's not of Republicans, that's not of Democrats, that's of everyone. A third of all mm-hmm. voters believe that. So okay. It just, what that shows you is just don't make decisions based on politics when you're talking about your money. It's not the right way to do things. It feels like it is, but it is not.
The market just doesn't care.
It doesn't care at all. It does not. If you had not invested under Clinton, you would have missed out on some of the best years. And if you had not invested under Trump, you would have missed out on some great years. Doesn't matter.
There was a chart this morning in the research I was looking at before the show, and it showed the I think it was the long-term average of where the market usually is on this particular moment of the third year of an administration. And the lines between the Republican and the Democrat presidents diverge here and there. Today, they are concurrent. There is zero difference at this stage of an administration as to which is one of them better or not for the market. It also showed that when you're in a spot like we are right now, generally speaking, the fourth year is nicely up. If you want to go just on charting and numbers like that, which is arguably a little bit dangerous perhaps, you will find out that you should really be fairly optimistic about the market going forward right now. We're in a place historically that looks like we'll leverage out for the rest of the year and have a little fun. That's just an observation. All right, government at work again, one more. The Treasury Department is now changing the rules for who gets a rebate on what electric vehicle, and they're cutting it down and making it so stringent that they're eliminating a whole bunch of electric vehicles from the rebate program that the administration is trying to push everybody to get into. Something about the left hand and the right hand comes to mind. The gap between them, very strange. All right, Christmas story. How's that one next? I got a whole stack of stuff to this. Fun. Everybody knows that the one of the big problems we have, especially pertaining to electric vehicles, but also with electronics manufacturing and so on, is the lack of rare earth elements in this country. There were a lot of mines previously in California, but they were shut down in the 90s, and there isn't that much left. So lithium and a bunch of the rare earths that are absolutely required for things like batteries and computer screens and so on and so forth, very hard to come by. Well, there's a guy he's on Wall Street. His name is Randall Atkins, and he apparently had a few extra pennies sitting around this year, so he decided he's going to buy, sight unseen, he's going to buy a coal mine for $2 million. So he wrote a $2 million check and became the owner of a coal mine in Colorado. So apparently he was getting it open, and they went down into it, and they found a vein of rare earth elements. Good for him, right? The value of his holdings now is 37, not million, billion dollars. Move over, Charlie.
That's pretty good.
Not bad, huh? Rare earth elements, $37 billion for a $2 million investment.
I wanted to jump back to the political thing because I was able to find another interesting thing I came across recently. If you had invested $1,000 when only a Democrat was president, it would be worth, this is since 1953, 1953, I think, when, 1953. Yep, since Eisenhower. If you had invested $1,000 and you only put it in the market when a Democrat was president, you would have $52,000. If you did the same thing under Republicans since 1953, you would have $27,000. If you put that same $1,000 in the market and just invested it the entire time, that would be worth $1.43 million.
Mm-hmm. And you can color me not even a little bit surprised on
so
that one.
Let that be a lesson about investing in politics.
The hardest thing, well, for everybody, including me, I'm sure everybody else, the hardest thing to realize is that timing the market just doesn't work.
And also, companies try to make money in all situations. Yep. They are not going to stop trying to make money because their favorite political party is out of power. It's not a thing.
If you question the brilliance of America's business leaders, it doesn't take that much to convince somebody that you're incorrect. They are very bright. They've got all the tools and the smartest people around them. And it hurts sometimes. We do, for our clients, we do drift in style a little bit. For instance, when interest rates came up, we had been pretty low on the fixed income type stuff, and we got into it. Adam was moving actually quite a bit into it over the last couple of years because rates were rising. And the one thing we always try to do is balance income and risk for people. The older the people are, the less risk you want them to be taking, and that risk is more prevalent in the stock market and the bond market. So when the money markets started coming back and they started yielding 3, 4, 5, 5.25, and the CDs now you can get and lock in for 1 to 5 years, they're over 4 and some of them are over 5. But that's the kind of risk reduction that's good for people, and particularly true if they've got money sitting in that account and they're coming up on the required minimum distributions. If you've got that money frozen, essentially risk-free, at interest, and the day comes up, then you don't have to do something stupid like sell out something that might otherwise be down. So we pay a lot of attention to that as we tweak things, but we don't tell people, oh my God, look what happened, or look who lost the election. We got to get out of this market, because if you do that, I pretty much just guarantee everybody you're going to lose. It does not work. In fact, long run, many, many studies have shown that market timing only contributes about 2% to your overall results, and that's just not enough to take chances with. So there you go. All right, the American dream. What is it? Well, it says a house and car and a couple of kids through college and a mortgage and all that stuff. They just priced it out, again, as they do periodically. The American dream now for one adult's lifetime, $3,455,305. So the American dream is very expensive at $3.4 million, and I would tell everybody, you got to think about that. That's just a lot of money. And if you got $9,000 or $24,000 and you're in the median saving range, better get on it. Charlie Munger joined Berkshire Hathaway a long time ago. Together, the two of them returned for their shareholders. This is a number you can hardly comprehend. 3,800,000%.
Wow. That's incredible.
What would have been an investment of $1,000 be today? You'd be retired in most cases.
Definitely.
As they could be, but didn't. Never appealed to them. All right. Well, it's been fun. We'll see you again next week at the same time.